The test of a man is how much he will bear for a cause which he knows to be right. How long will he stand in the depths of despair? How much will he suffer and fight? There are many to serve when the victory is near, and few are the hurts to be borne. But it calls for a leader of courage to cheer the men in a battle forlorn. It is the way you hold out against odds that are great that proves what your courage is worth. It is the way that you stand to the bruises of fate that shows up your stature and girth. And victory is nothing but proof of your skill, veneered with a glory that's thin. Unless it is a proof of unfaltering will, and unless you have suffered to win.
The Badlands. Explain those Badlands. That's a hell of a name.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Culture of Change. It's exciting to do this live with you. It's been a while.
I know. I feel like it's been like 84 years or something.
Oh, that's excessive.
In ages.
I mean, I think maybe it's been a few weeks. Yeah.
Don't call out my exaggeration so quickly. My God, what are you, an independent journalist or something?
I'm fact-checking you. So we are talking about groupthink tonight. This Christine Ohm dog thing really put it, put a fine point on groupthink for me this week. And we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about JFK and your experience last week going to Dealey Plaza. I was supposed to go with you, but I was snuggling my little baby niece and nephew instead. So
that's acceptable.
Yeah.
It's completely acceptable. It's funny how when you brought up the topic of groupthink and JFK, how they absolutely tie together. So it was like one of the first times in this modern history anyway, one of the first times that like Mockingbird was used en masse to create a groupthink about one narrative in one situation. So, and it's interesting because I can talk about kind of what me and Barb experienced there and what we overheard amongst people that were there and everything. It kind of ties directly in. So should be fun.
Yeah, it's a great example, and to kind of frame up the discussion about groupthink, we know that the term conspiracy theorist was coined in the wake of the JFK assassination, and that it was used to silence dissent, to reinforce the official narrative and publicly shame anybody that was looking to tell the truth about what was going on, or even just looking to find the truth. Hey, that theory doesn't make sense. You crazy conspiracy theorist, shut up or your life's going to be ruined. That is, JFK is a great example of that, but we see it happening. I mean, this tactic is on overdrive, I think, right now. I mentioned the Christy Noem dog thing. There are many narratives that if you question them, you are publicly shamed. And maybe even ostracized from the group. So we're going to talk about all of that. Why don't we get to our first sponsor?
Let's do that.
Your Patriot store. Patriots, are you ready to show your unwavering support for our troops, law enforcement, and country? It's time to visit your one-stop shop for all things patriotic, Your Patriot store. At Your Patriot store, you'll find the perfect gear to showcase your American pride. From brands you know and love, like Grunt Style and Nine Line, to everyday accessories for your home, pet, and auto. But that's not all. Discover new brands you're sure to love, from hand grenade hot sauce to bold 2-egg glassware to veteran-owned beef jerky and more. Shop for everything from flagpole kits to flagpoles and even Patriot tees for every day of the week. Your Patriot store is also home of the Buy 2, Get 1 on Us. Buy 2 shirts, get 1 free. Coffee, hats, stickers, flagpoles, buy 2 like items and get 1 free. And get this, if you use promo code BADLANDS35 at checkout, you'll get a huge 35% off your entire purchase. That is a massive discount. Don't wait any longer. Head over to badlandsmedia.tv/patriotstore and use code BADLANDS35 to show your patriotism without breaking the bank. That's badlandsmedia.tv/patriotstore, promo code BADLANDS35.
Yeah, That store is amazing, man. Did I ever tell you the story about the first time I ever read that ad? And like, I know that all of us during live reads at times have had flubs or had mistakes, but I think that perhaps my first ever read of the Your Patriot store ad might be the funniest, because when it got to the flagpoles and flags part, I said, go to Your Patriot store to get your fagpoles and fags.
Nice.
It was pretty epic, man.
But I don't think they sell those.
No, I don't think they do either. As a matter of fact, I think like they sell things that are directly the opposite of that kind of stuff. So it's awesome, dude. Like, you'll get lost on that web store, man.
My favorite ad read to date is when I did the Sheath underwear. I'm wearing them right now. We needed a girl version of that ad.
Totally noted. Totally noted.
All right. So we're starting with JFK. Why don't you lead the way?
Sure, man. Well, you had brought up, it was yesterday or the day before, I can't remember which, because they all just kind of run together at this point, right? You had said, hey, Sunday, why don't we talk about groupthink? Because we've seen a lot of that flying around the movement. We even discussed groupthink to a pretty deep degree on our spiritual/religious panel at CART last weekend. And so I thought it was a fascinating topic. And then we kind of started talking about me and Barb's trip to Dealey Plaza. And I'm not going to go through like more pictures of that, because I did that on Eye of the Storm. So I don't want our viewers to keep seeing the same shit from me over and over. And they'll see it plenty more in an article I'm working on anyway. But that led us to talking about, hey, you know, the JFK assassination was really kind of, it was almost like a, I won't say it was a testing ground for Mockingbird and getting the country thinking one way at the same time, because we saw that in World War II and previous instances, even, you know, far before that. But I think it was maybe arguably the most effective method of groupthink they've thrown up on the country at one time. And that was, of course, backed by the Warren Commission and stupid magic bullet theory. Anybody who's shot weapons at any point in their life before knows that there's just no way a bullet's going through multiple bones and coming out looking like it was not fired, right?
And how did it turn?
Right. Like, because bullets just, I don't know, man. Bullets just commonly completely defy the laws of physics, I guess. I don't know, especially when they need to sue the government.
The CIA needs them to, they do.
Yeah, let me tell you what, when the CIA needs them to, those bullets can grow steering wheels real quick. But so that kind of got you and I talking about how over time, we've kind of seen the groupthink through JFK get broken up a little bit, and how it's not, I think it's something like over 70% of the American public now doesn't believe the official story about the JFK assassination. And it's funny to me to take that fact into account when you go up onto the Sixth Floor Museum and you see them clinging so hard to the narrative. You know, they've got this neat little model built that's in the center of the floor there. And it's, you know, it's got the neat little strings drawn from the limo up to the sixth floor. And it's like just reinforcing that narrative. And then they've got this other wall adjacent to it that says conspiracy theories with quotes on either side of the word and talks about the magic bullet theory and all of this stuff. And it's, it was interesting to me to, be in and around the place and hear so many people just openly saying this is bullshit. Like, there's absolutely no way. And nobody was really doing that on the sixth floor. It was much more quiet and somber up on the sixth floor. But outside, like in the plaza and on the street and up on the grassy knoll, there were just, everybody I passed was just like, yeah, no, there's no way. There's no way the narrative is what happened. And so we can see from that how humanity and society, truth has come out about that. It kind of, truth always wins out, and we're seeing that with the assassination. I do think we're going to see the truth about it one day, but I think it's interesting to me how the groupthink has largely been broken with the JFK assassination at this point. And it applies to what we see nowadays with narratives we get nowadays. And I'm not immune to it either, by the way. Like, I'm not saying I never fall victim to groupthink or falling one way and then kind of coming back around later, but I think the JFK assassination is an interesting place to start, man. And I think it's, I also thought it was interesting. I don't know if this has any kind of relevance or whatever. I don't even know what to make of it. It's just one of those things I noted, but, and I think I said this in Eye of the Storm, but I can't remember. Anyway, so President Kennedy, when he flew into Dallas for that trip, he landed at Love Field, correct? And Love Field, I didn't realize it until we went to Dealey Plaza and passed the exit for Love Field, but Love Field is located on Mockingbird Lane. And I don't know. I don't know what that means. I don't. All I know is that it's really weird to me that the airport he landed at is located on Mockingbird Lane, and his assassination was arguably, at least to that point, the largest deployment of Operation Mockingbird we've ever seen from the mainstream media to that point. So I don't know what called to make of
Mocking.
That.
Was it called Mockingbird Lane in 1963?
I don't know. And I did try to look that out, and I it wasn't easy for me to find out. Perhaps people with more knowledge on how to dig on that kind of stuff could find out. But it, in either case, if it was named that at the time, or if the name was changed to that after the time, would almost be more interesting if it was changed after the fact. Like, I just, that just struck me as weird, man. And it has ultimately nothing to do with this episode. I guess it kind of does, because Operation Mockingbird, right? It's one of the ways they get groupthink really going.
How you drive it, yeah. I think we're going to play a cut from JFK to 9/11. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
9/11 is another, hang on just one second. 9/11 is another area. Like, when I think back on, I was in college, I was in my senior year of college when 9/11 happened. And, I lived in the dorms. My fiance, my now husband, and he was not my fiance at the time. He was my boyfriend at the time of 9/11. We got engaged about a month and a half later. Shout out to him. Today's our 22nd wedding anniversary. So happy anniversary to my amazing husband. But my long suffering husband. When 9/11 happened, I look back on my response, right? I've talked a lot, mostly with Patrick, but I think some with you as well, about how I was just a straight up flag waving Bush supporter. Let's fight back, strike back, shock and awe, all the things, right? And so much of that was patriotic groupthink. And that, you know, like, groupthink is not always negative topics. It's any narrative that, you know, the group decides on, and then you're not allowed to deviate. And so I think it's, you know, from JFK to 9/11 to Kristi Noem's dog to Israel and Palestine to Russia to China to all of the narratives, the border, the invasion. We need to make sure that we have our critical thinking turned on all the time. And that's kind of what we're going to get into today.
Yeah, most definitely. And the clip that I'm going to play from JFK to 9/11 is kind of his overview of the assassination itself. And the relevance is that it's one of the he's showcasing constructive thinking to break down a narrative, to break down a groupthink, right? The overall groupthink in America at the time for most citizens was, and you got to remember, I'm talking about the time initially in the aftermath of the assassination, was that, oh my God, this crazy lone nut gunman just took out our president. So when you look at it from the angles this guy presents, it shows how people were able to start breaking down the groupthink of the JFK assassination by asking questions like this. And I'm not necessarily asserting that what, you know, the outcome that he comes to is what happened or who all was involved, but this is how you do it. This is how you deconstruct groupthink, is by starting to look at something from an outside angle and starting to ask all the questions you can. So you got anything else to add, or you want me to go ahead and play it, Ash?
No, let's go.
It was now that Abraham Zapruder pressed the trigger on his 8mm cine camera. Ever since that moment, the world has accepted that what he recorded was the definitive account of what really happened. What people must appreciate is that what they have just seen is not at all what really happened. Had you actually been there on the day, this is what you would have seen. And doesn't that look a great deal more suspicious? So just exactly what did happen during the 10 seconds Zapruder was filming? To begin with, Dulles, Lansdale, and Attlee Phillips had tried to get over the problem of volley fire, blowing the president's head clean off, by firing in four stages. Stage one was meant to be a single shot by Charles Nicoletti into the back of Kennedy's head from the Daltex building some 40 yards behind. Had he succeeded, the plotters would have had the single assassin with one bullet story they wanted. But in his excitement, the mafia assassin squeezed the trigger too soon. His bullet ricocheted off the hard chrome sill of the limo's back seat and struck the curb beneath the overpass, sending up a sharp piece of concrete which scratched James Tague's face. Watch again. We clearly see how this little girl stops running and her gaze looks directly at where the shot originated and not up at the sixth floor of the depository. It was now that Umbrella Man took over. Standing right at the curbside, it was his job, should the first shot miss, to give a clear visual signal. Target is not injured. The intelligence chiefs knew that if this situation occurred, Kennedy would now be moving rapidly away from the first sniper. They knew the only way to make sure of getting him was to fusillade the car. So a moment later, two rifles tried to fire from directly.
And I'm going to stop it right there for a second for two reasons. Number one, because clearly this is going to show the assassination. So if you have an issue with that or you have a weak stomach, be warned. It
shows all children in the room.
Right. Yeah. Like it shows it multiple times. The second is because immediately within the first, minute and a half of playing this, these are the exact kind of questions you need to ask of situations if you want to break away from what you're being told to believe. It's like, notice where the little girl in the background is looking. Notice what's going on in the people in the background, because that's often what the mainstream media tries to drive you away from. They want you focused on a central focal point so you don't ignore everything going on that could really show what's going on. So that's pretty much all that I wanted to add on right there, if you had any more, Ash.
No, I'm super into this. I want to see the rest.
In front at exactly the same time to deceive witnesses into thinking there was only one shot.
You said you'd kill President Kennedy.
At the same time, I said I had killed the judge. I said I had killed Kennedy. Well, do you believe Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy? We'll get back to that. Alone, without any aid from a rogue agency of the U.S. government, or at least a portion of that agency. I believe you're very naive if you do.
Harrelson's bullet hit JFK in the throat, and another gunman, hiding in a culvert 50 yards away up in the embankment of the overpass, made the hole in the windscreen, which was later seen by Dr. Evalier Glanges.
The presidential limousine was there. Had been standing there for some time just watching the back of the emergency room. Talked to my friend next to me and said, look, there's a bullet hole in the windshield, and pointed it out to them. But it was very clear it was a through and through bullet hole through the windshield of the car from the front to the back.
As Kennedy emerges from behind the road sign, his distress is clear, while Governor Connally remains composed. This single frame of the Zapruder film makes nonsense of the single bullet theory, because it's quite clear both men have not been struck at the same time. Kennedy has now passed through two layers of fire and has not been hit in the head. To cover this eventuality, the assassins were given a simple instruction: fusillade the car with everything. So that in the next few moments, the five remaining riflemen fired, causing the Secret Service agent riding in the front passenger seat, Roy Kellerman, to report a feeling like a jet sonic boom as the hail of bullets whistled into the car. It is now more than 3 seconds after Kennedy is hit in the throat that Frank Sturgis misses his target altogether and blows out 5 inches of Governor Connally's ribs, compressing his lungs and puffing his cheeks. With a bullet, which quite clearly struck at far too steep an angle to come from the other end of the depository. In almost the same instant, Eladio Del Valle hit the governor in the wrist, Weatherford fired into his thigh, and Nicoletti's second shot hit the chrome frame of the window. A moment later, the best marksman, Malcolm Wallace, shot Kennedy in his upper back, the bullet strike witnessed and recorded by all the Secret Service men in the following car. Jackie Kennedy starts looking concerned, and yet even now there are no obvious signs that her husband, held upright by his back brace, has been shot twice. The assassins have so far failed to hit him in the head, and it is now that they play the ace up their sleeve. Here we can finally answer the riddle.
All right, so I wanted to interject real quick, because this is actually one area where I think groupthink takes over in the conspiracy movement as well, or the truther movement that wants truth in the JFK assassination, which I think anybody who's a truther does. One of the bigger theories that, I guess it's not a bigger theory, one of the theories you hear is that either A, Jackie did it, or B, the driver did it. And I think those are both red herrings to throw people off the course of where it really came from and who really did it. And when you see the restored Zapruder film, which I played on Eye of the Storm Tuesday night, you can clearly see the reasons that they removed frames from the film. It wasn't to hide the fact that Jackie or the driver did it. It was to hide the fact that the driver stopped the limousine so the kill shot could be delivered. And so that's kind of what I'm saying, how fake narratives are even interjected within the overall fake narrative. When people start getting close to the truth, they come up with stuff like Jackie did it or the driver did it. And also when you watch the Zapruder film that's been restored, you clearly see everybody that wasn't wearing a seatbelt lurch forward when the car stops. And that's kind of another sticking point to seeing what happened and everybody that was involved. The limo driver was absolutely involved, which he's going to get to in a second, but he didn't shoot him. And so to me, that's important as well as breaking down groupthink, is realizing that the truther movement will have false narratives injected into things as well to keep the truth from being hidden. And it'll seem like it lines up with our narrative and you're going, oh, hell yeah, they don't believe the official story either. But that's also a divisive and kind of deceptive tactic used as well.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. There are often layers, right, of fake details, fake things that can later be debunked, that are inserted into largely true stories to discredit the truth. We see that a lot.
Right. And anybody, you know, I brought up another point on Eye of the Storm as well, is that, like, If you've been around guns and fired guns enough, you know that the damage that was done to his head came from a high powered rifle. It didn't come from a handgun, somebody in the car. Like that's, it just didn't. So that's a classic example of me from the Kennedy assassination of something being used to take people off the trail. So unless you have anything else to add, we can get back to this, Ash.
Yeah. Of way on an empty street, you can hide a man with a rifle and how he can manage to shoot a man speeding past him in a limousine. The answer is that he can't, and that is why the driver, William Greer, looked around twice to see whether Kennedy had been hit in the head, and when he saw he hadn't, as dozens of witnesses, including police officers, confirmed, he stopped the car completely.
His orders was to slow down where the rest of the guys...
This is Greer, the driver of the presidential limousine.
Yeah, presidential limousine, yeah. Slow down almost to stop.
It is now that most people have been led to believe that Kennedy was shot in the head by Charles Void Harrelson, the sniper standing on the grassy knoll. This is not true. Because if we look at the angle of elevation of a shot from that area, it's obvious that a shot originating from above and right would have pushed Kennedy's head down and left. Whereas it's quite clear that his head is knocked upwards and to the left by the impact. So where did that bullet come from? Incredibly, the answer has lain hidden in the most well-known and iconic image from the assassination of the motorcycle policeman heaving his bike onto its stand. Look now as we freeze frame him here. This is the moment when the whole world was looking up the hill toward the man who had fired from the grassy knoll. But that is not where the police officer is looking. He is looking down into the storm drain, because that is where that shot at a stationary car came from. The shot, which all of the well-known assassination witnesses described as coming from behind the picket fence, missed completely and ripped up the grass at Jean Hill's feet. She did not even notice, but we know this is true because the FBI told her so. So who were the men who fired unseen from the storm drains on Elm Street? One thing we know is that they were very young and had to be brought into the conspiracy because they had to crawl into a filthy, smelly sewer, something which the older, experienced mafia assassins would never have dreamed of doing. They were basically two kids looking for excitement. The first was Curtis Laverne Crayford, also known as Larry Crayford. Formerly CIA, he had worked for Ruby at the Carousel Club. And Ruby had told everyone his name was Lee Harvey Oswald until Lee Harvey Oswald walked in. But while above ground, the world was taking pictures and running and screaming and trying to figure out what had happened, the other young man was stumbling along 400 yards of a reeking, fetid Dallas sewer pipe to emerge from this culvert. And he was not Lee Harvey Oswald or Roscoe White or J.D. Tippett, nor even a Cuban or Russian communist. His name was Jack Allen Lawrence. And we know that after stumbling up this bank, he turned up 15 minutes later at the Lincoln Mercury car showroom, where he'd obtained a job with false references, pale, sweating, and on a hot sunny day in Dallas, covered in mud. Telling his co-workers, Albert Bogard and Robert Tater, he had been ill that morning, he stumbled into the men's room and threw up while they, feeling his behavior was suspicious, called the police, who made a record of the entire incident. Back at the plaza, the guilt of the radio men coordinating the gunfire can be seen from their behavior. These two, Orlando Bosch and the Umbrella Man, have a seat while everyone else runs around them.
Dude's just hanging out like
Bosch
shit.
Bosch makes a report that the hit was successful.
We do that so often. Dude's just chilling like shit and just go on around him.
Right. But I want to just put a fine point on the narrative changes, right? So for so long, the story was single gunman, book suppository, Lee Harvey Oswald. Then it was there was a second gunman on the grassy knoll. In reality, it was a government conspiracy. The limo driver was involved. The mob was involved. The CIA was involved. You got guys running through running through the tunnels, sewer system. I'm trying to remember because the back and to the left was a big part of the JFK Oliver Stone movie, right? The bullets don't make sense because his head should have gone this way and instead it went back and to the left. But I think in that movie, that was used to prove the second gunman on the grassy knoll theory, not the young mafia dudes in the sewer theory. So even the debunks can be misinformation to dispel groupthink. And what does it do? Well, it makes it so, you know, you're a crazy conspiracy theorist unless you buy the official narrative, whatever the official narrative is at that time. And once you're a crazy conspiracy theorist, for the vast majority of people, that kind of public shaming is going to make you stop speaking up about it. You might still believe, you know, the truth or an alternate version of the truth, or just straight up believe, hey, this doesn't make sense. I don't know what is true, but I know that this isn't true because this doesn't make sense. You might still believe those things, but the vast majority of people are going to stop talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And it's especially like you brought up with the JFK assassination and the lone gunman theory morphing into the grassy knoll theory and then going into the movie JFK. And the movie JFK itself does have a lot of truth within it, I feel. But like you said, it's got those purposeful.
Yes. Yeah, I always accidentally say suppository instead of depository. I've done that on the air like at least 5 times. And I always, before I speak, think about it and then say it anyway. So sorry. Sorry, guys.
I was trying to go.
And Granda, yeah. It is.
And I'm trying to go full blown professional and just move past it over here like nothing happened.
No, it's my inner retard does that. I apologize.
Sorry, Miss Harold. Anyway, yes. So yeah, you know, the movie JFK, while it had some truth in it, it's actually a great example of stuff we see in this movement. And you know, you've seen me on my shows. I don't call people out by name, but we're well aware of. I'll use Q influencers as an example. There's certain influencers out there that say they get inside information or they know when something is going to happen or, you know, and this kind of stuff falls short. But the way they hook people in is by, you know, like 80-85% of what they say is true. But then the 15% of bullshit they hit you with is so over the top and filled with hopium that when it doesn't come true, it totally deflates your hope and your faith and makes you take a black pill and walk out, which is the purpose of that stuff. And, you know, that's why discernment is so big, right? You know, because you bring up a great point again about JFK and how it really hammers home the point of that other gunman on the grassy knoll. But when you realize that even something the magnitude of what happened to him and all the evidence supporting, such as the bullet holes and bullet strikes on the car and in the overpass and in the grass, that there's no way this just came from two angles of fire and there's no way it was just two people firing. And you start to really see that, especially with the stuff this guy breaks down in this documentary. But it's like, once you start asking those questions, you can certainly be prepared to see false narratives get interjected that you're going to have to fight against as well, that are going to try to throw off the real truth. And so
framed as truth telling, right? Framed as, oh, we figured it out now, guys. We figured out what the truth is. It's not this thing. They were lying. That's not the truth. It's this equally false story.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it ultimately, of course, goes to cover up the origins of all this stuff because it, you know, all goes right back to the cabal and the deep state and communism and wanting ultimate control over everything. And it was just so, it was just so eerie being there, man. It was so crazy just looking at the place where I'd, you know, kind of deemed a republic was sacrificed. Like you're staring at the altar that your republic was sacrificed on. You know, they even put an X in the road exactly where it happened. So it's like, yeah, it was really heavy being there, man. So did you want to carry on watching that or move on to some of the other stuff you have pertaining to groupthink?
Is that as far as you wanted to go with it? Because I think we have time to do a little bit more. Actually, yeah, why don't we hit our next couple sponsors and then we'll keep going.
Yeah, that sounds good. We could definitely go with how he breaks down the official narrative a little bit more. So,
with the gold.
I will go with the gold. But before I do that, I want to ask our kind folks out there to please go down there and smash that thumbs up button for us. It is like the biggest metric that Rumble uses and certainly helps us and Badlands Media out. So thank you guys so very, very much for watching and for your support and your love. And speaking of which, your support and your love of our advertising partners as well, because without them, there's no us. And me and Ash would be pretty sad about that.
Yeah.
Are you concerned about the $6 trillion at stake in the upcoming 2024 election? The Wall Street Journal has reported a critical issue, the looming decision on extending tax cuts scheduled to expire after 2025. Republicans advocate for extending Trump's tax cuts, while the Democrats lean towards letting them expire and increasing taxes on top earners and corporations, potentially creating a massive $6 trillion gap. But fear not. There's a way to protect yourself from this impending threat. Join the thousands of hardworking Americans who are taking proactive steps to safeguard their savings now. Visit BadlandsGold.com to claim your free 2024 gold and silver kit and fortify everything you've worked for. You may even qualify for up to 10% back in bonus silver, but hurry, supplies are limited. Don't leave your financial future to chance. Act now to diversify and shield your savings against the uncertainties ahead. Get your free 2024 gold and silver kit today at BadlandsGold.com and take control of your financial destiny. One more time, friends, that's BadlandsGold.com.
All right, so before we hit the next sponsor, I just want to shout out Jatriot. Give us a Rumble Rant. Happy anniversary, Ash. Great hanging with you guys at GART. Love you both. Book suppository, is that a form of speed reading? Maybe. It's a new form of osmosis. But I do want to give him a shout out because J-Trade adjusted my neck at GART, and my neck had not been adjusted in like 10 years. And I went back and I was watching the Colorado show that I do with Darren R. on 4 p.m. Eastern time on Sundays. I was watching last week's that we had recorded, and I feel like all of my shows, leading with that one, that all of my shows, I looked like this when I was on the air. And now I'm like taller. I have like a whole neck, and yeah. So Jatria is the best.
Like not like you're not like Quasimodo over there anymore.
I totally was.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about coffee. One of my favorite substances. Wake up to the bold flavors of Loaded Gun Coffee, where passion, precision, and patriotism infuse every sip. As a veteran-owned business, we ensure each cup is steeped in pride and unwavering commitment. Our roasters handpick the finest coffee beans from around the world and have mastered unique brewing methods. Our skilled farmers cultivate the coffee to embody the essence of duty and honor in every meticulously crafted blend. But it's more than just coffee. It's a family's enduring commitment to freedom, with military veterans tracing their legacy back to the Civil War, including Purple Heart recipients. Loaded Gun Coffee is a brewed testament of pride and honor, dedicated to preserving the integrity and strength of our beloved nation. We proudly stand as fierce advocates for a secure border and a strong America, and we stay loaded. Stay loaded, Badlanders, with Loaded Gun Coffee. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/loaded. And enter promo code Badlands for 10% off your purchase. That's badlandsmedia.tv/loaded, promo code Badlands. I am a huge fan of the black powder coffee. My husband is too. He loves it. And I had the opportunity of meeting Steve from Loaded Gun Coffee at GART. And that was awesome. Amazing experience. And really on the back of the coffee bag, they have the name of all those veterans that they mention in the ad read. So really great stuff. Absolutely delicious coffee blend.
Yes, it is. I met him as well at GART and enjoyed my time getting to talk to him. And he gave me and Barbara a bag of the pecan bourbon to bring home. And I'm addicted. I'd hurt people if they tried to take that from me.
Yeah,
definitely. Agreed. Definitely. All right. Well, let's get back to this now, friends. Watch a few more minutes of this talking about groupthink and how to break down an official narrative.
Then casually walks away. Just like the chief radio coordinator, Jim Hicks, with the radios clearly visible in their back pockets. A few yards away, the CIA's cleanup squad have begun working to remove all evidence useful to a forensic team. Deputy Sheriff Buddy Walters is here seen finding the bullet which struck in the grass near the manhole cover. He hands it on to one of the fake FBI men, who pockets it. While this is going on, Rogers, Harrelson, and E. Howard Hunt are discovered, hiding in the boxcars of the train which they hoped would be their getaway vehicle, until it's prevented from moving by railway dispatcher and key witness Lee Bowers. They are photographed repeatedly as they are marched to the Dallas courthouse. And we can clearly see in this picture the radio receiver Hunt is wearing in his right ear. which is identical to the receivers worn by those Dallas police officers who were part of the plot. As they walk, they are overseen by Colonel Ed Lansdale, who secures their release and begins to give the press the cover story that this man is the major suspect and that acting alone, he shot the president from behind. The truth, as we now know, is that 8 separate snipers firing 16 shots in 4 separate stages had tried to make certain of killing the president by hitting him in the head and had failed abysmally. The shooting on the day had been nothing to write home about. A third of all the shots had missed the car completely. Had it not been for the ruse of bribing the driver to brake at a point painted on the curbside, which is still visible, so that Jack Lawrence could shoot Kennedy in the head from just 15 feet away, the president might have survived. So now we must address the question, why does the Zapruder film not show this very obvious setup of the limousine stopping for the headshot? The answer, of course, is that it has been tampered with. In the 1960s, Hollywood special effects teams had developed techniques for masking off segments of film frames to disguise the true movement of figures within the picture. In the Zapruder film, frames have been removed in order to fake a continuous flowing motion so that we don't see the very obvious setup which dozens of witnesses reported. If you look now at the top of the frame, the doctoring of the film becomes perfectly obvious in the way in which the figures are blurred and yet the shadows are sharp, which is impossible. This CIA tampering with the evidence becomes even clearer when the Zapruder film is run next to the Orville Nix film taken from the other side. It's easy to see from the way the motorcycles suddenly close on the limousine that it stops completely. And we can see that frames have also been removed from the Nix film by the way in which Agent Clint Hill appears to move sideways while running forwards before leaping on the car. As the mad dash to Parkland Hospital begins, the chief coordinator in the assassination plot, George Herbert Walker Bush, the entrance of the school book depository. Now this is going to be one...
So basically, even back then, these idiots couldn't keep their false flags straight, and like we're leaving clues all over the time. We just didn't have the internet back then to disseminate it all and get it all over the place.
Yeah, well, that is so excellent point, because at the time that so many of these ops, you know, and we can go back. We're, you know, specifically talking about JFK. We'll talk about 9/11. We'll break this down a little bit more in a bit, but. Even when 9/11 happened, we didn't have social media. We didn't have as much access to information. We had 24-hour news at that point, which really has only served to create noise in the system and so much content that people have a hard time, you know, breaking it down. But the internet has changed the game when it comes to figuring out what's true, and we can see that with respect with you know, the operations that we see happening on us now. We can break them down and fact check them in real time, and, you know, slow down the videos and look at all the things, get access to the videos, screen record things. So I think that that's definitely game changing.
Yeah, I think it is too. I think actually the usage of the internet was something they really didn't account for insofar as being able to take over the world and control the flow of information. Like, it's completely backfired on them, man, and we see that every day. Time of Deceit showed that perfectly. If you've seen that yet or you saw the early screenings of it, that movie completely breaks apart official narratives and breaks apart their groupthink that they're thrusting upon society. It's fantastic. And we're seeing this kind of stuff all over the place now, which is really encouraging.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so why don't we hit Mr. Mike Lindell, our final sponsor, because I can tell I'm being glitchy again. So I'm going to try and refresh. I might need to reboot, so maybe just play a little bit more of the video if I'm not back in time.
Sure, sounds good. Yeah. Let's hear from our buddy and our friends at MyPillow.
I'm excited to announce we're having a huge MyPillow spring sale, and here's a few examples. Buy one of our MyPillow 2.0s, you get another MyPillow 2.0 absolutely free. Made with cooling technology, the best pillow ever just got even better. And this just in, 9 brand new colors and styles of our Percale bed sheets. They're made with the finest long staple cotton, and now you can save 50% or more. That's as low as $24.98. And for the first time this year, I'm bringing you our My Slippers and Sandals for as low as $25 a pair. So go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use your promo code to get your MyPillow 2.0s. Buy one, get one free. Percale sheets as low as $24.98. My Slippers and Sandals as low as $25 a pair. And for a limited time, when you order $75 or more, your entire order ships absolutely free.
One of those all too familiar Kennedy assassination moments in which people will say, well, yes, it could be him, but how can we be sure? Because we've seen this kind of thing before with Badgeman. However, a gentleman who I think must be a police detective has posted a YouTube video in which he utilizes the latest forensic techniques for identifying murder suspects by making a comparison between the photo taken in Dealey Plaza and one of George Bush in conversation with Richard Nixon during Watergate. This man points out that this
that's George Bush
has exactly the same skull shape, exactly the same hairline, chin, and nose as George Bush. He is also wearing the same type of suit, white shirt, and exactly the same.
I'm also going to point out that George Bush is literally the only person alive that didn't recall where he was in the day that JFK was assassinated. A clue, Watson.
Yeah, he's also not alive anymore.
Right.
He is exactly the same height, the same weight, is wearing clothing which matches down to his shoes, but most importantly, he has a characteristic mannerism of cocking his right wrist when he puts his hands in his pockets. We know from this declassified FBI memo that George Bush was in Dallas staying at the Sheraton on November 22nd. So can there be any doubt about this person's identity?
He didn't remember where he was, though.
Surrounded by the corrupt policemen he was coordinating, Bush knew already that if an honest officer should happen to catch one of the assassins, it would, because of what Mark Lane rightly calls plausible deniability, make no difference. Because what would they find? Mafia hoods with prison records as long as their arms? Or contract killers like Charles Harrelson? They certainly wouldn't have found anyone who carried CIA credentials or anyone whose involvement with the government could be traced. But even while he smiled and chatted to his fellow killers, Bush was unaware that the plotters had just made their first big mistake.
Yeah, that's called compartmentalization at its finest. And that's how they've kept the trail off of them. I think that's a good spot to stop that one. Otherwise, we're going to keep... We should have an episode.
I know, I could watch the whole thing. I started watching it when we got back from GART, and I fell asleep. And I was like, oh, man, I got to go back. Actually, I think I... Well, yeah, I fell asleep, but my phone also died in the middle of it. And so I need to go back from the beginning because that's really good. The amount of people that had to be involved, that can't be a thing. There's way too many people that would have to be involved in that conspiracy theory for it to be, taken off. I think for it to be true. And there's no way that many people can keep a secret, right? That's what we hear about all the conspiracy theories is that, oh no, that plot is too big. Yeah. The Luciferian cabal that's running the world, there's literally nothing that they won't do. They will conduct human sacrifice, whether it's one president or 3,000 people at the World Trade Center. They will kill people to achieve their aims, and war is very profitable. Both of those, 9FK, JFK and 9/11, both of them led to war, right? 9/11, obviously, we had the shock and awe campaign and then the 20-year war that never ended. JFK, very shortly after, Johnson put troops on the ground in Vietnam, which JFK was very resistant to. So they will do horrifying things to bring about what they want to happen. And it's always been kind of like, I don't know, prior to being fully awake. I'm not that I'm fully awake, right? I don't know how any of us can. How do we know? How do we know we're fully awake, right? Because everything's a lie. That being said, it always bothered me that these families kept having power, right? The Bush family, the Clinton family, the Kennedy family, these long-standing, the Pelosi, D'Alessandro family, right? These, you know, it's basically they're a political class that's bred to be politicians, and that's antithetical to the people choosing. That always kind of bugged me. Now, you know, being more awake, it's obvious. Because while it's a conspiracy that's very vast and requires so many people to be involved in it, when you have all of those people that are involved in it, either, you know, members of a small bloodline family group or the, you know, compromised, blackmailable associates of such a group, you can pull it off. You can get all those people involved in it.
And you have to recognize as well that a lot of people involved, basically everybody involved in the plot of murdering JFK, absolutely positively hated his guts and everything he stood for and would have no problem keeping that secret. Like, they hated him.
He was
that
a threat
much.
To democracy, right?
Right. And it's funny you brought up Pelosi there and her father, D'Alessandro, because Pelosi was an aide to JFK and D'Alessandro was business partners and mafia partners with Giancana, whose mafia, if you watch JFK to 9/11, that mafia was involved in supplying some of the hitmen for JFK. So it's interesting. I don't know. There's much to be drawn there, but when you know that, you know, it's kind of a not very well kept secret, right? That JFK jacked the 1960 election. He absolutely stole it. And he mostly stole it in Chicago and other mob heavy areas by kind of buddying up to the mafia. And his father did this mostly. You and I talked about this a little bit, but then as soon as he gets in office, he makes his brother the AG and they turn around and go right after these mob bosses and mafias. And so that's what triggered the mafia and pissed them off all at once, like wet hornets, to go right after JFK. And that's why a lot of people dismiss the mafia theory. I clearly don't think the mafia planned it. Like, they don't have power to change parade routes and call Secret Service agents off duty and call Dallas police off duty and this and that. But they certainly provided hitmen and they certainly got involved when it came to Jack Ruby and getting rid of Lee Harvey Oswald. Because if you watched Eye of the Storm, I don't even think Oswald fired a shot, dude. I think they had him show up at the depository and say, "Hey, dude, go wait there for a phone call." And that phone call for him never came. Meanwhile, up on the sixth floor, they actually had the assassins doing the work. And that, you know, it's, if you read into Lee Harvey Oswald's escape, it reads much more like somebody that went, "Oh shit, they're about to put this on me. I've got to get the hell out of here." You know, and it's just funny that when he spent time in New Orleans, he was actually joining up with anti-Castro groups and anti-communist groups, but then he's supposed to have wanted to go kill Kennedy. I don't know. Nothing about it adds up, man.
Yeah. So I just dropped the link to the show notes in the chat. Some people were talking about, you know, where can I find a link to the JFK versus JFK to 9/11? Everything is a Rich Man's Trick is the name of the documentary. It's like 3 hours long and we played like 15 minutes of it. So definitely check it out. All of the links to everything, as always, are in the show notes at ashinamerica.substack.com. And as I said, I put the link in the chat. So let's do, I want to pull up. Do you have the candid camera video?
Yes, let's do the candid camera video. Just give me a second to get it pulled up here.
Because I have it if you want me to just play it.
Oh, no, I got it.
Okay.
Got it right here. Boom. All right, go ahead and play it.
Go ahead.
In the elevator now is a candid star. These folks who are entering, the man with the white shirt, the lady with the trench coat, and subsequently one other member of our staff, will face the rear. And you'll see how this man in the trench coat tries to maintain his individuality, but little by little, he He looks at his watch, but he's really making an excuse for turning just a little bit more to the wall. Now we'll try it once again. Here's the candid subject. Here comes the candid camera staff, three of them at least. And this man has apparently been in groups before. Here's a fella with his hat on in the elevator. First, he makes a full turn to the rear, and Charlie closes the door. A moment later, we'll open the door. Everybody's changed positions. Now we'll see if we can use... see if we can use group pressure for some good. Now, in a moment, on Charlie's signal, everybody turns forward. Notice they take off their hats. And now, do you think we could reverse the procedure? Watch.
I mean, it's funny, but that dude just got worked.
So it, you know, you have a laugh track to tell us that it's funny. And oh. Candid Camera was a comedy show. The founder of Candid Camera is a man named Alan Albert Funt. He was born in 1914, passed away in 1999. He was born into a Jewish family in New York. His father, Isidore Funt, was a diamond wholesaler, and his mother was Paula Saferstein Funt. He graduated from high school at the age of 15, too young to attend college on his own. He went to the Pratt Institute and then ended up going to Cornell and Columbia. He was very into psychology. He was he also had some pursuits where he did laugh therapy for seriously ill patients. He taught psychology at Monterey Peninsula College. And I, you know, probably would have laughed at that video when I first saw it. Now I see it as kind of mocking. It's mocking us that we're that easily manipulable, but we are that easy to be manipulated. It's just a fact. The social pressure of conformity is a very great pressure. It's a significant amount of pressure that can be applied.
And that was a group of like eight people. The pressure only amplifies and exponentially so when it's millions of people telling you to do the thing, like put on a mask or get vaccinated. All of society. Right. Yeah. Like it's so I'm much the same way. Like that's why I said, you know, it's funny, but it's really not, because you're literally watching that guy kind of get worked and almost hypnotized and brainwashed to a degree. His actions were preconceived and predetermined, and they knew that would be the outcome. It's just it's literally watching a thought experiment on a group of people. That's
well, yeah, and that was at a point in time, one, before our attention spans and you know, processing capacity had been so degraded by, like we talked about before, there's messages coming at us all the time from all angles. We carry the supercomputing message delivery device in our hands with us everywhere that we go so that we don't miss a message, right? The news cycle. I mean, just watch Badlands Daily. There's so much news that is worth us, you know, we think is worth us tuning into. So many different storylines and so many different theaters, and we're kind of like trying to keep up with all of it. So there's been, you know, impacts to our ability to process and keep, you know, critical think about what stimulus we're getting. We're now overwhelmed with stimulus, so that you kind of have to pick which one you're going to dig into and apply your critical thinking. And a lot of people are just like, okay, we're going to go, you know, going to go. They can't. Not all the news stories can be lies, right? So we're just going to pick this one, and you know, the rest of it we're just going to accept as part of the official narrative. And that is intentional. Right. This next video that we're going to play gets into a little bit more of the science. So that was kind of a, you know, fun, candid camera kind of thing, but it highlights how ostensibly the guy in the elevator didn't know those people. He wasn't part of any sort of defined social group with them, except elevator riding. We're all in the same elevator, and this is a group that I'm a part of. And the social pressure of four strangers in an elevator was enough to make him conform. What does that look like when it's members of your trusted group, of your right. the groups and tribes that you identify with? This next video gets into it.
Which one am I playing next?
I only gave you two, so it's the other one.
I had three in there.
The other one is that Dutch lady. I don't think we're going to have time for that. We might actually have time for it, but
okay, cool. Well, then I did good, because this is the one I already have pulled up.
Perfect.
Groupthink. Groupthink occurs when people's desire to maintain group loyalty becomes more important than making the best choices. People often find it hard to think and act independently in group situations. According to psychologist Irving Janis, groupthink is a deterioration of mental efficiency, reality testing, and moral judgment that results from in-group pressures. Group members often suffer overconfidence and hold an unquestioned belief in the group's competence and morality. Dissent by group members may be discouraged and even lead to expulsion from the group. Because people often want to avoid these punishments, they remain silent. This creates the illusion of agreement or unanimity in the group. Groups may also reach decisions, including moral judgments, which are more extreme than any single member of the group originally supported. Unfortunately, if groupthink takes hold, group members may not even question ethically dubious decisions and actions. For example, some people say that the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq because of non-existent weapons of mass destruction was due to groupthink. Indeed, groupthink can cause us to value harmony and consensus over independent judgment, and can lead to unethical behavior.
So, can lead to unethical behavior. That can be, yes, we need to go in for the weapons of mass destruction and, you know, bomb everything and level it all into a parking lot because America, right? It can be, what else can it be? So I put this question up for the chat, not so much the pressure points, but the group constructs. So I think family is a big one. How many people were pressured throughout COVID, the time period of the COVID pandemic, to change their behavior and their way of thinking because of their family, because of, you know, family pressures, sick parents, right? Other things like that. Work tribes. I've invested so much into my career, I'm just going to go along. And the problem is, you know, and then there's the social tribes and clubs. We see a lot of that with, there was that video the girls from Columbia that went down to, I think it was NYU, and they're asked, like, what was your, why are you here? And they're like, I don't know. Like, I wish I was more informed about why we're here protesting, right? The tribe told us it's time to protest, so we're protesting.
Right.
So it's very interesting how we're seeing that show up.
I had an example of this in me and Barbara's personal life. We, the gym we go to, one of the fellas that goes there back in 2020, and that whole thing was very big into BLM. And it's like one of the nicest guys I know, right? Like, he's also one of the fiercest martial artists I've ever met, but he's also one of the nicest guys I've ever known. He's not in the least bit racist, doesn't at all hate white people, doesn't at all think white people are the scourge of the universe or the root of all evil for black folks, like, not at all. But he got he got pushed into the narrative. He got groupthunked, as it were. Like, he got, and so, well, here's the black man with another white cop and his knee on his neck, and the guy's yelling, "I can't breathe," and the black man's dead again, and I'm going to buy into it. And so fast forward a couple years after the fact, when everything starts coming out that Black Lives Matter didn't donate not one single penny to any black community anywhere.
Not in Denver, they didn't. Nope, the BLM people in Denver told me that.
Right. And then you realize that the founders of BLM themselves are Marxist Leninists, and that they're buying themselves multi-million dollar homes in Los Angeles and the Hamptons and Cape Cod, and nothing is going to black communities. Meanwhile, these people are also driving the destruction of predominantly black communities. Like, it just, this kind of woke a lot of people up to the BLM stuff. And this guy kind of came around as well, to where it's like, look, I was wrong. Like, this is, you know, like, obviously Black Lives Matter. And I think that's another thing that got kind of funneled into groupthink, was people were made to think that if you said, hold on, let's question Black Lives Matter, well, that automatically makes you a white supremacist racist. We can't listen to what you're saying. When all we were trying to say over here is, like, from the get-go with that group, there was plenty of us that was like, hey, you guys know the founder of BLM is literally a Marxist, right? That, like, she's
self-described, yeah.
Right, like, that they're literally employing Marxist, brown shirt, World War II, fascist era tactics to get their message across. Because our enemies, the enemies of this country, know you were never going to bring a full-on army onto our shores. You were never going to march full-on army's boots onto our country and take it over, right? So how do you take it over? Look at Antifa and BLM. Let's insert little soldiers all over the country through means of protest groups. And I think you're going to see this ramp up over this summer too. Like,
well, but also they did move 12 million troops.
Yeah.
Through our southern border. Lukeycom says, Ash, I sent a package with a book in it to you at GART. Since I couldn't be there, did you happen to get it? Sundays are the best with you two and Defected. First of all, thank you for the rant and for your kind words. Second of all, yes, I received it. You made me cry. Your letter is incredibly beautiful. And I wanted to wait to write you back until I had read the book. So I read the book, but then I couldn't stop. So I read the second book, and now I'm waiting for the third book to come out. I kind of want to interview the author, because she's amazing. But you will have a response from me in the mail soon, because I finished the second book, then I went to and realized there wasn't a third book out yet. Then I went to grab your letter so I could write you back, and I couldn't find it. And yesterday I found it. So it's my gratitude is complete and full for you. You're absolutely amazing. And also you will be getting a response from me.
I'm going to interject for a moment as well. Kind of a little bit personally, it doesn't really have anything to do with the episode, but whatever. You know, one thing I've loved about Badlands and meeting everybody and doing the GARTs is, if you followed my journey, you know that I was decidedly an Anon before all this, and I was not very much of a people person. I've not been shy about saying how much of an introvert and how private I am. And getting to meet so many wonderful people that just support you through thick and thin and have your back in this war has most definitely started to break me out of that shell. I think a lot of you saw that last GART. And, you know, it actually just dawned on me, too, that this is our first, obviously, live episode since, you know, GART. And that was actually the first time that Ash and I, we'd met in Florida, but we literally spent zero time together. It was like a hug in passing a couple times and a short, brief conversation on the beach. And like, we were kind of a little annoyed about that, because we're good buddies, but we didn't get to spend any time together. But we did at this GART. And dude, I just want to say, like, I echo that person and all the kind words folks have to say about you. You are so much more lovely in person than you are in camera. It's like, that's hard to say because you're lovely on camera, but in person, I mean, me and Barb went out to eat with Ash while we were there. It was just lovely. Like, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
That meal was so good.
Oh, God. I know. Now I'm hungry again.
That meal was amazing. Yeah. Well, Silent Whisper is talking about barbecue at the top of the show. I'm super hungry for barbecue. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And blushing. Don't really know what to do with it. But, yeah, I mean, the love of this community. I love the Badlands community so much. From not just the content creators, but everybody.
Barbara's back here gloating, throwing her hands up in the air, going, "I ate all my food."
She did. Yeah, I said she couldn't. I said she wouldn't be able to finish her bowl of food because it was bigger than her head, and she did finish it, and then later admitted that she had overeaten just to prove that she could.
Well, she was useless for the rest of the evening. I'm just going to throw her under the bus right now and let you know that. Coma. Like, Yeah. There was the itis hit her hard. I love it.
All right. So, you know, so the power of groupthink, the power of being led around by one, your emotions, right? Oh my God, I can't believe she shot a dog. How could she shoot an 18 month old puppy? This poor little amazing puppy. Okay. The dog was a working dog on a farm and had killed chickens and tried to bite its owner. But oh my God, puppies. I love puppies. I hate Christy Gnome. Right? Like that's the response
Tell me you've never lived on a farm or a ranch in your life without telling me you've never lived on a farm or a ranch your life. Like, I get it. We all love animals and puppies, but if the dog was rolling around their farm, killing chickens and going after livestock and going after her kids, then guess what?
And
sorry if I sound cold or harsh.
No, you're not.
That's cold how country harsh, life
it's
is.
The reality. That is the reality of, you know, when you're,
these
when
people
you're
think on a- she's, these folks think she's the only person in the United States of America that has ever done this.
So, well, then the goalpost moved, right? Then it's okay, fine, working dog. She can do what she wants, but she shouldn't have written about it. And that really pisses me off because then it's like this incredibly accomplished woman, governor of a state, you know, beautiful, consistent, generally in principle. There's, I don't like some of the stuff she did with the trans stuff in her state and, you know, there's other policy things we can dispute, right? But the idea that she needs to edit her story, her personal story, and she needs to edit it so that other urban dwellers that are going to attack her anyway won't have their feels hurt. That irritated me even more than the initial reaction to the dog story is now we're, you know, the group has decided we're moving the goalpost and we're going to talk about her decision, her judgment in deciding to publish the story. Meanwhile, none of them have actually read her book. They've read the one piece that was taken out of context and turned into a whole big hullabaloo and they think they know everything. She didn't even try to rehome that dog. You have no freaking idea what she did with that dog. You don't know because you're only reacting to the stimulus that's right in front of you.
Right. Like here, look, I've got a spoiler alert. We all love animals, right? Sometimes some dogs and cats can be assholes, like straight up possessed. Nothing you do is going to set them right. We don't know how that dog was. And it also, look, I'm a Q guy. I'm a 40,000 foot. I'm a 40,000 foot view guy. Right. So everybody's in an uproar because she offed a dog, right? And the left is especially all over her nuts for offing a dog, right?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting at the same time that Fauci's coming back into the news. It's almost like that's being used to get that spotlight going, and maybe it's going to shift over to his crimes of the same nature, which were actually inhumane and far larger in number. Like, there's a vast difference between putting down a dog that's causing a problem on your farm and tying a dog out in the middle of the desert for sand fleas to attack its exposed head. It's a big difference in the two. Okay. Like, and then people were reeing over her killing a goat. The goat was literally attacking her children, like, and attacking other goats on the farm and going after female bearing goats. Like,
I heard somebody say they should have donated the goat to a petting zoo. It's like, no, you missed the entire story.
Right.
Like, I don't want it to attack my children, so I'm going to donate it so it can attack other people's children. And also, do you know where goat meat comes from? Right?
Oh, like, and goat is delicious too. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm gonna
so
be
many
that
people
guy.
think that their food comes from the grocery store, that their meat comes cut up into nice little chunks for them at the grocery store. These people will not last long in the apocalypse.
No, these are the. It's funny because we talked about this on the phone earlier today. These folks, you're going to need to find yourself some butchers to be friends with. I assure you, hunters and butchers, you're going to want to be friends with.
I married one.
Nice. I can.
Yeah.
I've never actually went hunting. I can shoot a gun, but I've never went hunting. That said, I'm a pretty damn good butcher. So.
Mm-hmm. And the barter economy will require such things. Will require, you know, those kind of skills. That's one of the things that we're, you know, relying
look,
upon.
Look, let me tell you, like,
we have usable skills.
99%
of
my
husband has usable skills. I really don't.
99% of folks want to eat a really good steak. Like 1% of those folks actually want to do to the cow what has to be done to get to that steak.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's life on the farm. But, you know, a lot of people. And then I had one person straight up honest, which I appreciate the honesty. One person in my comments was like, I don't like Christy Gnome and I don't want her to be the VP. Now we have a reason. It's like, okay, at least you're honest.
Like, at least they're honest about it. Like, yeah. I can respect honesty, but just when you're just going to hop on a groupthink, instant knee-jerk retrain, that shit just has really been getting on my tits lately. Like, especially the last few months. Like, it's just triggering me quicker than it used to. It's like, we're far enough along in this thing where when anything happens, you should be able to take a couple steps back and let it breathe for a little bit before you rush to talk about it. But I agree. Politically, it was kind of dumb to talk about it. Shit. I mean, you shouldn't talk about it.
This is an anecdote in her book, in her autobiography. The fact that this anecdote was taken out by people that hate her and turned into a whole big deal, I do not think means she should edit her autobiography to accommodate people that are going to attack her anyway. There are a hell of a lot of rural voters that can relate to the story that she told and Absolutely. Will be disgusted by the reaction to the story that they're told, because right. rural people that live in the country understand what it means to have to put animals down, understands what it means to be dealing with vicious animals, understand right. what, you know, one of our I don't know if this is public knowledge, so I'm going to hedge a little bit, but one of the Badlands folks that we know has been dealing with the aftermath of a rattlesnake bite on a child over the past week or so. And the child has been in the hospital. It's taken two rounds of $100,000 anti-venom to deal with. Is killing the snake amoral? Does the snake have greater moral value than the human child? Because people sure think dogs do.
Well, if the dog was biting, say the dog had bitten her child, okay, if you're living in my city in Charlotte, North Carolina, and you have a dog that bites a child, you know what's going to happen? Animal control is going to take that dog and they're going to put it down.
Yeah.
So maybe she did try to rehome it and they were like, oh, wait, it's bitten children? Sorry, can't do anything. And like you said, we just don't know that. But so many folks in this movement nowadays, and it's not just a right side thing either. I'm not just slamming on conservatives on our side of the movement. I want to be clear about that. But it's a societal thing where it's just like, oh, let's just rush to this judgment. She offed a young 18-month puppy. Whoa, so evil. What's wrong with her? Meanwhile, the fruits of what she's done throughout her life and her career as governor have kind of shown she's not really an evil person. Maybe her discernment lacks at times, maybe misjudgment at times, but come on, guys. It's an 18-month-old puppy that was going after other animals on her farm.
Well, yeah, and honestly, I'm gonna straight up tell y'all can all persecute me too. I don't care. If a dog has bitten a children, I'm not rehoming that dog.
No.
You could call Cesar and he can, you know, fix the dog and it won't bite anymore. Maybe, but it's an animal, not a human. Its life is not of greater moral value than a human life. And the liability, you can also, by the way, be held liable after you mm-hmm. rehome the animal if something happens. I'm not rehoming that dog. That dog right. is in, if that dog is in my sphere of influence, it's being put down if it's bitten a child.
Yeah, I remember, man, it was about 16 years ago or so. Me and Barbara were together, but we hadn't gotten married yet. So it had to have been right around 15 or 16 years ago. And we had a neighbor that had a couple of, they weren't pit, they were part pit bull. I can't remember what they were bred with, but they were part pit bull. And don't worry, I'm not one of those people that immediately rees against pit bulls, I promise you. One of our best friends has a pit bull and it's the most adorable dog you've ever seen in your life. It truly, like, I know it's a cliche, but how you raise them matters big time.
They're so happy when they smile.
They're so doofy happy when they smile. It makes me smile. But anyway, he had these two dogs and my neighbor across the street had a chow. Now chows are notoriously mean as shit and can snap like that. Right. And the two pit bull mixes were as sweet as could be, just such loving dogs, man. And they had a third dog that was a little golden retriever or golden lab. Sorry. Cocker spaniel. That was it. Sorry. And he was adorable too. And so One day, the neighbor across the street with a chow was out front on his porch, and the two pit bulls and the little cocker spaniel were out front the neighbor's house next door. And the chow just snaps and comes charging across the street and goes at the cocker spaniel and grabs it by the neck and starts ripping it around. And so the owner of the cocker spaniel comes out of his front door and dives on the chow and literally beats this fucking dog to death. I'm not like, not exaggerating. So would you say he's in the wrong for that? He was protecting his pet. That his pet wasn't doing anything. And his pet was also like, all three of his pets were on a leash in the front yard. Like they were leashed up to a post in the front yard, and we had a pretty peaceful neighborhood. So it wasn't out of the norm to do that, to like have your dogs out front kind of playing around on long leashes and stuff. So it wasn't out of the norm at all. So this guy comes out the front door with his chow that wasn't on a leash, comes charging across the door or across the yard, tries to kill the little dog, and dude beat the shit out of it. And it was rough to watch, but he wasn't in the wrong.
Yeah, you know, pit bulls get a lot of bad press, but chows, many such cases with
chows. Is that Clay Parikh, by the way?
That is Clay Parikh, who says, what about cats, birds? I feel like we're favoring dogs too much. This show is going racist against other animals. I put this up because somebody came at me on Twitter today and said that I was an evil predator operating in the name of God, because I said that that her life, I was actually lifting up this person I was talking to, said her life had greater moral value than a dog's. Because you're human and you're made in the image of God, and God breathed life into you, and God gave dominion to man over the animals. And then I was told that I was a predator for saying that. And my response is, wait a second. What about cockroaches? If you kill a cockroach, should you be treated as though you killed a human? What about ants? What about a mole in the backyard that's digging up all your plants? What about snakes, like we just talked about? Where is the moral line drawn, right? If you intentionally step on an anthill, should you be prosecuted for murder? That is where this, you know, there's no difference between humans and animals. There's no moral difference. The value of the life between humans and animals, there's no difference. That's crazy town. But yeah, it is. There's a lot of people that have fallen for it in the wake of this Christy Noem thing. And I think that it's important to point out where this happens on our side, because it's really easy to say, look at the social justice people in their groupthink, look at the BLM groupthink, look at the climate groupthink. But we have loads of groupthink on our side, and we need to. When we were at GART, this is the last thing I'll say, I'll let you bring us home. But when we were at GART, somebody said to me something along the lines of, in a very nice way, you're a contrarian. And I said, oh, thank you. Yeah, my dad's been telling me that my whole life, which is true. But he raised me that way. My parents raised me not, you know, from a scripture standpoint, to be like a Berean. Don't just believe that something that somebody religious tells you. Search the scriptures, figure out what's true, test everything in the spirit. When it comes to consuming the news, figure out what's true. Consume all the different, sources. When we're writing, I think most of us do this. You can jump in and say, because you write for the brief as well. But when we're writing the brief, we get the story that we're covering. And then generally I do, and I'm pretty sure BB and you and others do as well. Check what are the other stories that are, you know, what are the other headlines? What are the other sources? And where is there a dispute of facts? All of that kind of stuff takes more time. Takes more effort, but if you're not putting in the time and effort, turning on your critical thinking and doing the work yourself to figure out what's true, but just to trusting authoritarian sources because you're part of that group, you're part of that tribe, and you totally trust the tribe, they wouldn't lie to you, right? The tribe would never lie to you. So you're just going to believe whatever they say. It's a very, very dangerous place to be.
Absolutely it is, man.
And somebody in the chat called me a cougar, and I am happily married for 22 years. Thank you very much.
I will say that first I'll start responding by saying, since I've gotten to know you, especially since you and I have gotten closer, I'll say you're absolutely a contrarian, but in the best possible way. I wouldn't even say you're a contrarian. You challenge people, and you do it in the best way. You've at least done it for me in the best way. You've challenged me personally in private phone calls and chats and whatnot, and things that I've believed pretty strongly, and you've challenged me and you've made me think about them from different angles and different perspectives, and actually changed my thoughts and opinions on a couple different things. So I don't think that's ever a bad thing to be willing to challenge other people when you feel pulled to do so. I think it's actually a gift. I think you do it very well.
Thank you.
The second thing I'll say is, Clay, I absolutely love your work, man. I've followed you for a while, and I love everything that you do for election integrity, my friend. So keep on going. Hat tip to you. The second is
you're going to make his head so much bigger. I love you, Clay.
The thing about cats, we love cats around here. I'm actually a cat person. I don't own any dogs. And that part of that's because our landlord won't let us, but I prefer cats. That's not to say I dislike dogs, but I love cats. I'm indifferent to birds. I love birds, but I don't think I would ever own a bird, if that makes sense.
I have owned birds. I had a love bird when I was a kid that I was 8 maybe. Loved that bird. Lovebirds, you're supposed to get 2 of them because they need to be lovey. And we only had one. His name was Lovey, actually. And he would, hide in our neck, or he would just pinch his little beak on your lip and like hang off of it. He was such a little pal. And me and my little 8-year-old self introduced him to the dog. He didn't bite. He put the bird in his mouth and was so proud of himself. My Malamute. Childhood Malamute, so proud of himself, thought he was doing the best thing ever, and the bird had a heart attack and died. It's horrifyingly traumatizing. So my husband is like, "I want a bird," and I'm like, "No, I am. It's a hard no on the bird."
I actually think the reason I'm against owning a bird is probably based in trauma as well. Because when I was a kid, we did own a bird up until the time I was about 11 or 12, and it was a cockatiel, and he was pink, and his name was Floyd. And we woke up one morning and we didn't keep him locked in his cage. He was very well trained. We kept the door to the cage open and he would just fly around. When he had to go to the bathroom, he'd fly back into his cage, use the bathroom, fly around the house. He'd gotten on top of the cage and the cage broke loose from the ceiling and fell on top of him. So I'm pretty sure that's probably 95% of the reason I don't want to own a bird. I was just straight up PTSD traumatized from that shit as a 10-year-old seeing that, 11-year-old, whatever. I think to wrap up, what I'll leave folks with, I first heard it for the first time as an intro to a Tool song, but it actually comes from Timothy Leary and it falls right in line with going against groupthink. And he said, "Think for yourself, question authority. Throughout human history, as our species has faced the frightening, terrorizing fact that we do not know who we are or where we're going in this ocean of chaos, it has been the authorities, the political, the religious, the educational authorities who have attempted to comfort us by giving us order, rules, regulations, informing and forming in our minds their view of reality. To think for yourself, you must question authority and learn how to put yourself in a state of vulnerable, open-mindedness, chaotic, confused vulnerability to inform yourself. Think for yourself and question authority." That doesn't mean disregard authority, but it means question what you're told and don't always believe everything you're told up on first glance. Dig deep and be willing to confront yourself, because sometimes the answers you're going to find are going to be things that make you really uncomfortable and really vulnerable. And that's what he's talking about. You've got to be willing to be that vulnerable and check your own truth to really find the truth.
Beautiful. That was beautiful. I see so my chat got cut off. I can see one Rumble Rant McSarge, $08, $10. I'm here at General Flynn Movie VIP meet and greet right now. See you guys later. Amazing. I hope you have so much fun. That sounds awesome. And sure, I don't know if you're able to scroll before and see if there were any others that we missed. I don't want to miss any.
Let me check. No, I believe those were the that one and the one prior and the one from J Triot were the only ones today.
Perfect. All right, everybody. Well, please make sure that you hit that thumb on your way out. Nothing Can Stop What Is Coming is up next. And so we'll be heading over there when we're done here. And what else? You have sports talk tomorrow?
I do. It's going to be pre-recorded.
Are you going to talk about the Avalanche and how amazing they are?
I might do that. But no, sports talk tomorrow is actually going to be pre-recorded. J Triot is stepping in for JB. JB is going to be out of town. Nice. For some personal stuff. So me and J Triot are actually going to pre-record sports talk here when I get done with Culture of Change. So guys, make sure you tune in to me and J Triot tend to be complete children when we're together. So it's probably going to be pretty funny.
That sounds awesome. I will be back tomorrow morning on The Brief with Patrick. And later tonight I am recording with Alpha. I'm going on his podcast. I don't know when that's going to air. I think it's recorded. So
yeah, Alpha's amazing.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. So we'll see you guys when we see you. Remember that change happens one conversation at a time. So be brave and speak the truth. We'll see you guys next time.
Bye-bye, friends.
Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God. that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. Stand, therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth, and having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and as shoes for your feet, having put on the readiness given by the gospel of peace. In all circumstances, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying at all times in the Spirit, with all prayer and supplication. To that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints, and also for me, that words may be given to me in opening my mouth boldly to proclaim the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that I may declare it boldly as I ought to speak. In Jesus' name, Ephesians 6, 10 through 20, the whole armor of God. Friends, first off, thank you so very much for joining us. We truly and deeply appreciate your continued support and love shown to us here at Badlands Media. Don't forget to hit the thumbs up on this video and help get this show on the Rumble leaderboard. Another way you can support Badlands for free? Become a Badlander. How do you do that? Head on over to badlandsmedia.tv, click connect from the top menu, and then click be a Badlander. Once you're registered, you can download clips from your favorite Badlands shows to share on your social media accounts. You can also print out flyers and stickers that you can hand out at an event and more. Let's keep growing our community because we are the news now and we take that very seriously. Thank you again from Badlands for your support and your love. It is appreciated more than you know.